Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting the next interview in the continuing series with Dr. Maria Clave, pioneering world-renowned computer scientist, president of Harvey Mudd College, board director of Microsoft and Broadcom, keynote speaker at the first World CIO Forum, past dean of engineering and professor of computer science at Princeton University, former vice president and dean of science at the University of British Columbia in Canada. Maria, you are an icon in so many domains where your innovations and accomplishments laid foundations in science, education, leadership, innovation, and research. This is the last in an interview series where we explored your considerable history from your early years and into your professional life of notable distinction, significant, outstanding contributions in a number of fields, including societal causes. Thank you for sharing your considerable expertise, deep accumulated insights, and wisdom with our audience.
It's a pleasure to talk with you, Stephen.
Now, Maria, in this series of questions, we're taking a chronological journey from your 30s, starting with takeaways from our first two interviews. However, before we begin mining your history, let us discuss any current updates you have about your work. So where is Harvey Mudd heading today and why?
Well, as you know, the number one focus for Harvey Mudd College is creating the best possible undergraduate science and engineering education in the world. And one of the things that we've really been focusing on in the last few years is to do more than just offer that education to our own students, but to become a lab for innovation that can explore possibilities and then share the results of these with other institutions, and in fact, even collaborate with other institutions, usually much larger institutions, on how, you know, a particular educational approach that's worked well for us might be modified to be really effective for them. And so I see Harvey Mudd College as a resource for the whole world. And, you know, we all know that there's a tremendous demand for scientists and engineers in some areas, computer science being right at the top right now. And so it's exciting to think of doing what we can do with our own group of 750 students, but then also sharing it more broadly with other institutions around the world.
What are the three top recent achievements of Mudd?
Well, I think the one that we're best known for right at the moment is that about 40% of our computer science majors are female, up from about 10% in 2006. And this is due to amazing work done by the faculty in our computer science department, where they transformed the introductory computer science course from being a pretty typical learned program in Java course that was required for all students to take but was hated by most, to literally the most favorite course of the vast majority of students. And what's so interesting is it was all done by changing the context to make it about problem solving using computational approaches, which of course involves doing lots of coding, because how are you going to solve a problem with a computational approach if you don't actually program it? But it just made it so interesting and so much fun for our students. So that's the one I think that's gotten the biggest press. Another one that I think is just as amazing is that about 2 years ago, or actually more like three now, our faculty were thinking about the fact that even though our students take a lot of courses in social sciences and humanities and the arts where they do a lot of writing, we just weren't seeing those writing skills transfer into the technical disciplines. And so our faculty came to the conclusion that the problem was not with the students, but with the faculty, in that faculty in physics and engineering and math and CS, chemistry and biology didn't know how to teach writing. And so our faculty decided that we would offer a half-semester writing course to every student in their first semester here that would be taught by faculty from all across the college, which would mean that faculty from physics, math, CS, and all the other disciplines would have to learn how to teach reading and teach writing. And at this point, more than 40% of our faculty have actually taken the workshop and have taught in the introductory course. And so there's a lot of talk at institutions about writing across the curriculum, where students, you know, are supposed to have writing assignments in across lots of different kinds of courses. But we call this writing across the faculty because all of our faculty learned to teach writing. Well, not all 40%, but more are learning every summer. And what's interesting is the faculty who've done this say that it makes them not just a better writer themselves, but it makes them a better mathematician or physicist or computer scientist, whatever their discipline is. The third one I'm going to mention, and this is, you know, sort of a joke, but we're proud of it in any case. There's an organization called payscale.com that rates colleges according to how well paid their graduates are, both in the first 5 years after they graduate and 15 years after they graduate. And we've been ranked in the top three since they started doing this rating. But they now do something called the Best Return on College Investment, which combines tuition, financial aid, and salaries. And we were rated number one for return on investment this year. So, and the other thing I'll mention is that our median salary for the students who go straight to work after they graduate in 2006 was $57,500, and this year it was $77,500. So a really significant increase over just a six-year period.
Maria, those are some remarkable achievements, so congratulations.
Thank you. Of course, I'm not responsible for any of it. It's the great work that our faculty and students do, but I am very proud of the college.
Well, it does speak to your leadership. Now, Maria, you have ongoing relationships with many programs and with notable world leaders. Can you share some stories?
Yes. So I think the most exciting thing that happened to me since we talked last was I was involved in a retreat on the use of technology to significantly improve K-12 math education in the United States. This retreat was held at Sunnylands, which is the former home of noted philanthropists Walter and Lenore Annenberg. And the exciting thing about this retreat was it brought together 22 people, including Bill Gates, Sal Khan, Alan Schoenfeld, Governor Bredesen, and, you know, another 15 or so people. And the whole idea was to bring together people who, first of all, the leaders who are actually developing technology-enabled approaches to math education, together with school superintendents, math educators, cognitive scientists, politicians, and to really think about whether there is an opportunity now to make a significant push forward. And the thing that I really learned from this experience, first of all, it was probably the best weekend, the most informative and important weekend I've spent in my life. I mean, it was just an amazing group of people. And the other thing that was amazing out of this is that even though these people were coming from very different backgrounds, very different perspectives, at the end, we reached unanimous agreement on what we needed to work on. And the number one thing on the list, which I never would have guessed before the weekend started, was the importance of actually having trusted research studies that evaluate the effectiveness of approaches. Because it turns out that nobody really believes the research claims from anyone. And so it's almost impossible for school districts and individual schools and states to actually decide what approaches are going to be more effective because nobody believes that the studies are actually measuring the right thing. So one of the things that we're working on after this retreat is to see if it's possible to create some kind of organization or approach that would allow for people who are doing, who are designing, building these technology-enabled approaches to math education to actually do research studies that people would believe. So that retreat happened at the end of April. It was, we put about a year's worth of work into organizing it ahead of time. It was a total joy working with the organizers, Robin Kramer from, and Jeff Cowan from Sunnylands, several people from McKinsey, and, several people in the Gates Foundation. But it was just, it really showed me what you can accomplish if you really put in the effort to pick a great group of people and also do a lot of pre-work so that everybody's coming to the meeting with an understanding of what they expect to achieve. That was one. Another one, which was a lot less work to organize and but also extremely exciting, is the launching of the Women of the Northwest Dinner Series. So this is a this is built on Sheryl Sandberg's Women of Silicon Valley Dinner Series. Sheryl hosts a dinner at her house roughly every 4 to 6 weeks, and she will have leaders, both male and female leaders. She'll have, as honored guests, she'll have an honored guest at each dinner series. And essentially, the honored guest talks briefly, and then there's an opportunity for the attendees to ask questions. And typically, there'll be between 50 and 60 attendees, and they're women who are leaders, mostly from technology, but also from, you know, politicians and other industries as well. And I was approached by a young woman named Alex Tibbett, who at the time was at Microsoft and has since then moved to run the online shopping operation at Nordstrom's. And Alex said that she really wanted to start a Woman of the Northwest dinner series in Seattle because there didn't seem to be any networking opportunity for women leaders in the Seattle area. And we decided that we would try to get Melinda Gates, Bill's wife, to be the first honored guest. And we had our very first dinner. Melinda was the guest. She was so inspirational. I'd never met her. And she was just fabulous. And we had just under 60 attendees. We had, you know, women leaders from universities, from several different companies. And the buzz was just amazing. And it was just like there was so much energy there and excitement that it was just an amazing event. So we've decided we're going to hold these Women of the Northwest dinner series around the times of Microsoft board meetings so that I'll get to attend all of them. My role is that I get to be the person who interviews the honored guest. And so we'll be doing another one in September. And I just, you know, I never would have thought of doing this. That Alex had been to one of the dinners somehow at Cheryl's house. I knew that Cheryl was doing them. And Cheryl helped us with the organization. I mean, and that she told us, you know, like a lot of details and well, actually Cheryl's assistants about how to go about doing it. But it was just fabulous. So the final one I'll tell you is I have these crazy friends. Actually, only one of them's crazy. The one that's crazy is called Lenny Barshak, whom I adore, and his wife is Erin Smith. Erin has just joined the board of Harvey Mudd College. They live most of the time in Sun Valley. And Lenny decided that what I really needed to do in terms of increasing my networking was to participate in a ski race called the Silver Cup. Now, the Silver Cup was started by Mike Markula, who's one of the early investors in Alpa, in Apple, and was, I believe, chair of the Apple board at some point. Mike started this as a way to celebrate his 20th wedding anniversary with his wife 20 years ago. And this race happens every 2 years, and I, of course, have never been in a ski race, and it's one of these things where you're on a team of 10 people. There's a pro who is your coach, and you do some preliminary runs for your time so that you're given a handicap, and then you race. And it was an incredible amount of fun. Two, I got to meet a lot of people I didn't know, including a couple called Peter and Deb Riemann, and Deb has just joined our board as well. And I also had to vastly improve my skiing in order to compete in this, so I took about another 6 days of ski lessons with my favorite ski instructor at Sun Valley in January and February. So it was just a great experience.
Those are really quite remarkable stories, and I can see them sort of inspiring a lot of people to get involved in some way to make a contribution back. And those are just terrific. Maria, you serve on many different kinds of boards and are highly respected for your deep insights and candor. Do you have recommendations from these experiences?
I think the thing I've learned from serving on boards is, first of all, every organization has things you can learn from it. They all have different challenges. They're usually in sort of different stages of their evolution. And, you know, so the first thing is the opportunity to learn. The second thing is most of the influential people I have met one way or another in my life has come from serving on a board with them. And so, you know, one of the opportunities that it gives you is to connect with other people who have similar interests and passions. And then, of course, the third thing is, obviously, you know, you want to be on a board of an organization, whether it's a company or a nonprofit, whose mission you really care about, because you want to be making a contribution to something that you find interesting and important. And, you know, I was lucky that I think my first really major board that I went on was a trustee of the American Mathematical Society, and I was nominated for that by Ron Graham, who is a very well-known mathematician and who was, you know, one of my mentors early in my career and continues to be a very good friend. And, you know, I think he thought it would be a good experience for me. And I remember when I was first asked to do it, I said, I just can't because I've got too many other things I'm doing. And he said, are there things you could stop doing in order to make space for this? Because this is, you know, something that will really teach you a lot. And I remember that because a number of times since then, I have, you know, stepped down from things I've done for a long period of time where I felt that perhaps I was not adding as much value, and moved on to a new experience where I felt I was going to learn more and have more impact.
You know, that's some very, very good advice for people who aspire to be on board. So thank you for sharing that. So now in this interview, we will continue our discussion about your history. So for the first question, from our earlier interviews, how would you summarize the shareable lessons?
Well, I think one of the things that has characterized my life is the importance of being willing to learn new skills and new areas of knowledge, because the places where you can actually have impact can change throughout your life. And if you're not willing to learn, you're going to have many fewer opportunities. And then the other, you know, things I would say is, you know, the importance of persistence and hard work. I mean, I tell people all the time, if you want to make a difference in the world, first of all, you've got to choose something important to work on. But, you know, after that, the most important thing is to be really, you know, focusing on working hard and being persistent, not giving up too soon. And then knowing when you need to learn something new, learn a different approach, learn a different skill set in order to make progress. And then the other thing I think I've really learned is knowing to ask for help. It's amazing how often we don't ask for help when in fact help is there and is available.
What were the most memorable events and contributions from your time at the University of Toronto?
Well, obviously the really big one was learning about computer science, because that was, you know, when I went to start a second PhD there, I knew nothing about computer science, and by the time I left 2 years later as a faculty member, I knew a lot about computer science, so that was a very big thing. But it was also an exposure to a particular kind of culture within an academic department. It was a very supportive culture, one where the faculty had very close relationships with the graduate students, and, you know, also one where I think the people were essentially happy. And that had a big impact on me, because as I then went forward to build departments elsewhere, I, you know, really noticed the impact of having had that experience at the University of Toronto and having absorbed a lot of the values from that department and wanting to replicate it in new institutions. And, of course, by far the most important thing in my life that happened while I was at Toronto was that I met my husband, Nick, when he came to give a talk. And, you know, we just celebrated our 32nd wedding anniversary. And, you know, I have to believe I might not have met Nick if I had not gone. I mean, if I had stayed just in mathematics, I might never have met Nick. And, you know, certainly he had this close relationship with many of the faculty at the University of Toronto. And so I'm deeply grateful for that.
Well, congratulations on the anniversary. And with regards to the University of Toronto, it's interesting when I do talk to people related to that computing department there, they still say that it's a great atmosphere. It's very friendly and very supportive and non-competitive in a sense. So I thought that was quite remarkable. Now let's extend the prior question to your time at IBM Research.
So I was at IBM Research for 8 years, and, you know, one of the wonderful things, opportunities that both Nick and I had there was being part of a community that was building a world-class theoretical computer science department and building one with a very special culture. And I think, you know, we really wanted to have a place that had some of the best people in the world, that was very collaborative, that took advantage of people from different areas of computer science and mathematics being able to work with each other. And the other thing I learned, a very big thing I learned from being at IBM, was Ralph Gomery, who was the director of research for IBM when I first started and then became senior vice president for science and technology for IBM. Ralph would come and give, you know, perhaps one talk a year. And it's funny because when I went to be dean of engineering at Princeton, I went to visit Ralph, who was at that point the president of the Sloan Foundation. And I said, Ralph, I just wanted to stop by and say thank you, because one of the most important things I learned in my life, I learned from you. And he laughed and he said, well, what was that? And I said, one of the things you talked to us as researchers about was the importance of having impact, of choosing problems to work on where the solutions would really make a difference. And he looked at me and said, oh my goodness, you were actually listening. And I mean, that really was, Ralph was an enormously wise and talented man. And he really inspired me with this idea that, you know, there are lots of interesting things to work on in the world. So you might as well pick the ones that are going to make the most difference. And I have really used that as a way to think about, you know, career decisions and choices at various times, is where is one going to have the most impact. So the final thing that I really learned from being at IBM Research, we built this amazing department. It had 25 researchers. And, you know, at the time when we were doing this, IBM Research was just one of the best research labs. Well, there were several labs, but industrial research efforts in the world. And the other one was Bell Labs. And, you know, both of them are just a shadow of what they once were. And so when we left IBM to go back to academia, one of the things I thought very hard about, I realized the fragility of what we had built at IBM Almaden. And, you know, what was then 25 researchers, now 8 today. And, you know, the vast majority of people whom we recruited are no longer there. I mean, they've gone on to do great things at Cornell University and Berkeley and, you know, Rice and lots of other places. But I learned that industry research labs are only stable for as long as the company is extremely wealthy. And once it's not, they go.
You know, it's interesting. I've had discussions with professors who've had long histories in both industry and academia, and some of the older ones perhaps feel that maybe the research in industry was even perhaps even superior than the research in academia, but there's been a bit of a switch now where maybe the research in academia is superior. Do you have any views on that?
I think there are still some places where really excellent research is being done in industry. One of them is Microsoft. Now, of course, that's very, you know, I mean, one of the things that was interesting at the time about Bell Labs and IBM is that they were doing fantastic research in mathematics and physics, in as well as in computer science. And now the vast majority of what's really being done in industry research labs is something in between, you know, some mix of computer science and economics and mathematics. I don't think there's really much physics going on other than applications to, you know, phase transitions and networks and so on from statistical physics. But, and there is some, physics going on at Microsoft Research and at Santa Barbara. But, you know, I think that everybody, especially watching what just recently happened with Yahoo, where Yahoo had roughly 600 people working in their research labs, and, you know, most of those people have now left, because the short-time CEO, Scott Thompson, did not really see the value of research. There's some research being, I mean, some excellent research being done in Google, but for the most part, it's not published. So, you know, it's not really benefiting the world in the same way that academic research is. So I think it's really true that at the time of, you know, the height of, you know, the very best work at Bell Labs and IBM Research, it was the best place you could go to work as a researcher in those fields. But, you know, it's just very sad to see what has happened over the last 25 years.
And especially for yourself, because you've seen the quality of research in industry, and you've seen sort of this switch due to, you know, economic reasons and for other reasons. Now, you were at the University of Toronto. You've done work at IBM Research, but you also spent time at UBC. What led you to go to UBC?
Well, the first thing I should say is I had said for a very long time that there needed to be a great computer science department in Western Canada. Obviously, as great computer science departments were growing in North America, Canada had two of them. One was Waterloo and the other one was the University of Toronto. And, you know, at the time I went to start my second PhD at the University of Toronto, it was one of the, it and Waterloo were among the top 10 departments in North America. And they were okay, I mean, not bad computer science departments in Western Canada, but there wasn't one that really stood out as being phenomenal in the same sense that Waterloo and Toronto were. And so for a long time I had said that it would be a really, you know, there ought to be one. So that was part of it. And I had already decided, Nick and I had always intended to go back to academia. We had been at IBM for, you know, 7 years at the time, IBM Research for at the time we started looking at other institutions. And just by chance, the province of British Columbia decided that, you know, it wanted to invest in a knowledge-based economy as opposed to a resource-based economy. And of course, British Columbia at that time, you know, most of its income came from forestry, fishing, and mining. And those are quite cyclical as industries. And so they, there was a minister called Pat McGeer of Advanced Education in the government at the time. And he decided that they wanted to, invest in computer science, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering at what were then the three universities in the province, University of British Columbia, Simon Fraser University, and University of Victoria. And as part of that, the person who was the head of the computer science department at UBC, Jim Vara, started a center that was going to coordinate the new resources coming into UBC into electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, computer science. And so, and they decided to do a search for a new head of the department. And, you know, the sort of the goal was that the department would become a world-class computer science department in 5 years. Now, at the time, we had offers from a number of other institutions, but one of my research collaborators, David Kirkpatrick, contacted me. David had been at UBC for several years, and we were very good friends, and in fact our families were friends. We used to vacation together in the Okanagan, and he contacted me to say, we're looking for a department head, we realize you're probably not interested, but just in case. And so since we were considering other places, we decided that we would actually go and interview. Another thing that was going on was that at that time our children were roughly, you know, turning three and turning six. And I, being Canadian, having grown up in Canada, I had a strong desire that our children would actually be educated in Canada. And particularly, I really wanted them to go to French immersion because, you know, French was the first language that my parents spoke to each other. It was the only language they had in common. And so I had grown up hearing lots of French, and I'd always really valued that as part of my culture. And the final thing was that my father was getting older, and they were both my parents were very close to our children. And I thought it would be really wonderful for them to have the opportunity to spend more time with both, you know, Nick and me, but also with their kids. And, you know, in the end, we were choosing among, you know, we interviewed at maybe 20 institutions. We ended up with a dozen offers. We reduced it down to what we thought were the four extreme points of the set, so the ones that weren't dominated by anything else. And one of them was UBC. And, you know, the salaries at UBC were going to be half of what we were going to earn elsewhere. The prestige of the institution as far as computer science was by far the lowest of any place we were looking at. But, you know, Nick and I got up one morning and looked at each other and said, you know, we've always said that we are that we're people who want to make a difference with our lives and that we're altruistic. And now we have an opportunity to do something that nobody in their right mind would probably choose to do, so let's do it. And we did.
Wow, it seems like a common sort of theme in your life, that you take on these grand challenges and then you master them.
So. Yeah, well, you know, I think I probably told you that, you know, when we list the wonderful things that have happened in our life, you know, like for Nick and myself, number one, the most important one was getting married to each other, and the next one was having our kids, and the third one was moving to UBC in Vancouver, because it was just a wonderful choice. And it was really hard, but it was really worth it.
So you're now at UBC, the University of British Columbia, and as we just discussed, it has some opportunities before you, but will also involve a lot of work. So can you describe some of your roles and contributions at the university?
So when I started out as head of the computer science department, we had about 13 faculty, and I think we had perhaps about 50 graduate students, and undergraduates, hard to say, maybe 400 or 500 undergraduates throughout the 4 years. And you know, by the time I finished 6.5 years later, we had almost 30 faculty, and we had tripled the number of graduate students. We tripled the amount of research funding. We had a brand new building, which was like totally gorgeous. We had been in the most depressing building you can imagine before that. And we had created a culture and a set of values for the department that one of the things I'm most proud of, I mean, today the department has more than 50 faculty, and it still has the same set of values and the same culture. And so, you know, it was just an amazing experience. So the values we created, the first thing was that we knew that most universities had grown their computer science departments 15 to 10 years before this happened at UBC. So it was actually a very good time to be doing it because there weren't as many, there wasn't as much competition for top young assistant professors coming out as there would have been a decade before. And each year we interviewed between 20 and 25 candidates. And we would have them at the department for 2 days. I would meet with them. I was generally one of the first meetings on their first day, and I would have dinner with them one-on-one the evening of their first night. And I would tell them what the department, how the department chose people to make offers to. And I would say there are four threshold values, and you need to be above the threshold on all four, and they're not weighted. One of them is we want you to really want to be a great researcher, because you don't build a great department without great researchers. But you don't have to be an empire builder the same way that you would have to be at MIT or Stanford, because we know that there's value from quiet, collaborative researchers, from loud, persuasive researchers, from every kind of style, but we want excellence. The second one is we really care about teaching, and you don't want to come here if you're not interested in teaching both undergraduates and graduate students, because we're an educational institution and it's really important to us. The third one is you have to want to be part of a team that's building a great department. So the advantage for a junior person is your opinion and your work will count in this project in a way you would never have the opportunity at a more established department. The disadvantage for a junior person is you're going to be contributing at a level, you're going to chair committees, you're going to do all kinds of things you would never do, and we're going to take that into account when it comes up to tenure. But, you know, it's a different proposition, because you're going to be just as important as the most senior full professor in this department. And then the third thing is we value the community that we have. We want to be a supportive community. We want everyone to have respect and trust. And people would look at me and they'd say, well, how do you ensure that you get those values? And I said, well, you just tell people that that's what you're looking for, and the ones that aren't interested self-select out of the mix. And it was really true. I mean, because we were very, I mean, we would say, look, we can't, our salaries are not competitive with the U.S. Our research funding is not competitive with the U.S. So what do we have to offer you? We have really two major things to offer. One is you can make a big difference with your life because you can help build this department. And two, it's going to be the best, nicest, most collaborative, supportive department on the face of the earth. And so you're going to get a wonderful community of people to work with. And of course, if people self-select for lower pay but more impact, you get better people. So it was just that whole, I mean, I would say until my job as president at Harvey Mudd College, that was my favorite job ever. It was just so exciting. It was really hard. I mean, that we had so little money to do what we were doing with. I mean, we just, like, for instance, our equipment budget for the computer science department in 1988 was $4,000 a year. You couldn't even buy one workstation for $4,000. And, you know, so we had, I mean, we just had a ton of work to do. We were successful in getting the university to give us much more in the way of resources than they had ever imagined, much more than what the province did. And for that, I gained a lot of enmity from the chemistry and physics departments that were extremely well funded compared to us. And, you know, there was some rebalancing done, and they didn't think about that computer science was a science discipline. You know, they thought it was a terrible thing that the university was pushing this computer science department. But we succeeded, and it was just an amazing experience. And one of the things that I recognized around the time I'd been chair, department head for 6 years, was that it was going to be really important not to stay on too long as department head, no matter how much I loved it, because I knew that I would not stay at UBC forever, and I wanted the department to own what it had created. I didn't want it to be Maria's department. I wanted to be the Department of Computer Science at the University of British Columbia, that is one of the best places on the face of the earth. And a lot of people had said to me, while I was department head, they'd said, you know, you ought to be a university president. That's what you would really love doing. You'd be really good at this. You have the vision, you have the drive, all that kind of stuff. And so in my seventh year, when a job opportunity came up for this Vice President for Student Academic Services, known as VPSAS, I looked at that and I sort of thought, well, that was one of the five vice presidents reporting to the president at UBC. It has two responsibilities that really interest me. One is it's responsible for the information technology infrastructure and planning for the campus. Another one is it was responsible for everything to do with students. And I was very aware that the undergraduate students, particularly at UBC, felt very undervalued. And from my perspective, they were actually, they were getting a great education, but they just felt like widgets in a factory. And so it seemed to me that this particular role would be an opportunity to, first of all, find out whether I'd like, you know, this very senior level of administration, and to try and fix two things that I thought should be fixed, namely how the students felt about their experience. And, you know, this was late 1994. We had no plan to network the campus. We had no plan to get faculty access to computers. The only way that faculty got access to computers is that they could buy them off their research grants. And, you know, people in the social sciences and humanities did not have research grants in general, so there was no way they could get them. And so I decided to be a candidate, and I was eventually selected. And I spent 3.5 years, and in that period of time, we managed to dramatically change the way students felt about their UBC experience. And the easiest way to sort of tell you the difference is, at the beginning of that time, when students, you know, there's a graduation convocation ceremony, and only about 75% of students who are graduating would actually show up. By 4 years later, the numbers were well over 90%. And, in, you know, like I would have all of these people saying, this was the best 4 years of my life, this was wonderful, UBC is the most incredible place, et cetera. And we also, by the time I finished my 3.5 years as vice president, we had a plan to network the entire campus. We had managed to get computers for virtually every faculty member that wanted one. And we'd accomplished lots of other things. So, you know, I felt like I had accomplished what I wanted to do. But the other thing was that one of the things I learned was, and you know, this should have been obvious to me ahead of time, but there's a real difference between being an administrator on the academic leadership side of the house, which is, you know, basically department head, dean, provost, president, and administrator on the services support side of the house, which is what the VPSAS position was. And, you know, I love educational institutions, but I love them because of the education and research that goes on. And what I realized is that I would be much happier being on the academic leadership side. So when the position of Dean of Science came open, I applied for that and eventually ended up in that role. So one of the other things I should say is that one of the things I didn't anticipate when we moved to Vancouver is that I knew it was a great place to raise children, but I had no idea that once we were there, there would be no way we could move until our kids had graduated from high school. Our daughter in particular just made it clear she would just divorce us and live with her best friend if we thought about moving someplace else. So, you know, I might have been more likely to move on to our presidency right after the VPSAS role if we hadn't been basically condemned to live in Vancouver for a number of years by our children. And, of course, Vancouver is my favorite place to live in the world, and, you know, we were really happy with the education that our children got in the Vancouver public schools. And so, you know, condemned is I'm joking when I say that. It was a really wonderful time in our life. And during the time I was Dean of Science, I'd say the things we're really focusing on, one of the things we're really focusing on is the Canada Research Chairs, Tier 1 and Tier 2, had just been announced, and so we were busy doing a lot of strategic planning and then a lot of recruiting around a number of research chairs that we were able to get in the Faculty of Science. We had a major growth in terms of interdisciplinary research collaboration. Our female faculty when I first arrived at UBC, out of about 300 faculty members in the Faculty of Science, there were 11 females. I was the 11th, and I was the fourth female full professor out of probably over 200 in Faculty of Science. When I started as Dean of Science, there were 24 female faculty out of about 285. And when I finished the work 4 years later, there were 48. So in 4 years, we managed to double the number of female faculty. And, you know, we went from having, you know, 2 in mathematics to 7 in mathematics, from 2 in computer science to 7 in computer science, from, you know, less than 1 in chemistry to maybe 4 in chemistry. I mean, it was just an amazing transition. You know, the other thing I worked really hard on was getting undergraduate students more involved with the Faculty of Science. We started a science ambassadors program that had, you know, between 100 and 300 students a year as volunteers, and it was definitely a great experience.
Rhea, you touched on some of this already, but maybe let's focus, and that is, what were the opportunities and challenges at UBC?
So the obvious opportunity is that it's a fantastic university. I mean, it's just a truly great university. There were young, wonderful people, wonderful faculty, wonderful students, wonderful staff. It's in, you know, the best city in the world as far as I'm concerned. And even within that city, it's in this amazing location, you know, out on Point Grey, and, you know, just a spectacular place. The challenges, I would say, are, first of all, you know, IBM was a very forward company in terms of, you know, really trying to promote women and underrepresented minorities into leadership positions, and, you know, having gender neutral language, and when I moved to UBC in 1988, it felt like I'd gone back 20 years. I mean, gender neutral language had never been heard of. I mean, it was I remember asking candidates for the position of Dean of Science. I was on the search committee, and I would say, what are you going to do to increase the number of women in the Faculty of Science? And they would look at me and they'd say, well, I don't object to having women in the Faculty of Science. I mean, they just didn't realize it was an issue at all. And so I would say Vancouver and the University of British Columbia was much further behind than IBM had been in terms of all the issues about equity and discrimination and all those kinds of things. The second thing I would say is that, I mean, the money is, I mean, there's just so much less money in the Canadian higher education system. I mean, we did amazing things with, you know, just such limited resources. But, you know, I think of the 15 years I was there, we had budget cuts probably all but 2 years. I mean, and significant budget cuts, you know, 3%, 2%, 5%. So funding was always an issue. But the thing that, you know, eventually caused me to leave is that, unfortunately, Canada is really invisible to the United States. And unfortunately, most of the culture of science and engineering is set by the United States. I mean, this may change over the next 50 years, but it hasn't changed yet. And so if you wanted to change something more broadly than simply in your own institution, you can't do it from Canada. Because, I mean, I would talk about, you know, we had this tremendous success in recruiting female faculty. And I would talk about the, you know, I remember giving a talk at two mathematics department chairs in D.C. And I was talking about the approaches we used, and people just laughed. And they said, of course you can do that at a place like UBC. It's in Canada. It's a kinder, gentler country. And it was sort of like, no, you could do this at your institution, too. It just takes leadership. But, you know, it just was not believable to them. And, you know, I finally decided that if I wanted to have the kind of impact that I want to have with my life, I was going to have to leave Canada. And that's pretty heartbreaking. I mean, I love the University of British Columbia. I loved living in Vancouver, and I loved living in Canada and being Canadian. But, you know, there just are limits.
That's a good segue into what led you to Princeton. But before I ask that question, didn't you also initiate or sort of help grow the sort of relationship you had with the University of Washington?
When I first went to UBC, so one of the things about the University of Washington is they have a number of people who either did their PhDs or their postdocs at the University of Toronto, and so did UBC. And Ed Lazowska in particular is, I met him when I was a graduate student at the University of Toronto. We've been friends ever since. And So Ed was, and it was quite interesting because at the time that we were trying to, leaving IBM and deciding what we were going to do, at some point, Ed had invited us both to apply for positions at the University of Washington. And we declined to do so because we had a close friend called Marty Tompa, who is also Canadian, and at least I think Marty. No, I guess he's American, but his brother Frank Tompa is at Waterloo in Canada. Anyhow, Marty is was a good friend, a theoretical computer scientist, and he had given up his position at the University of Washington because his wife was going to medical school, and so he'd moved with her to basically, they had two young children, and, you know, to support her going to medical school. And we declined to apply because it was pretty clear if Nick and I went to the University of Washington, we're both theoretical computer scientists, there'd be no way they would hire Marty back. And we knew that Marty in the long run wanted to go back there. And I remember telling Ed this and Ed going like, wow, that's the best reason I've ever heard for not applying for a job because you care about somebody else getting the job. And so Ed was, you know, whenever I needed data on anything, whenever I needed, you know, something to convince the UBC administration, I would just call up Ed or email Ed and, you know, he would help. And it was very funny because for a long time, all of the really great PhDs graduating from the University of Washington, their first job interview was at UBC. And it took us forever to actually recruit any of them, but we finally did. But they thought of, it was sort of their dry run for an interview. And, you know, it's, so I think the University of Washington just sort of thought of us as, we were the farm team. They were the major league, but it was a great relationship. And now, you know, both departments are doing extremely well.
So you talked about, I guess, the reason for leaving UBC and seeking, I guess, the more opportunities in the U.S. because of the, just the, you know, the standards that are set there, that, you know, they then go global and the funding levels are just out of this world and so on. So can you get more into what led you to Princeton?
Yeah, so it's a pretty funny story. So I got called by Harvard when they were looking for a dean of engineering. This is at the time that they chose Venke. And I got called by a faculty member, and I didn't remember this, but Nick remembered it. And, you know, at that time, it was about 6 months before I talked to folks at Princeton. And they had asked if I, you know, would consider being a candidate for the Dean of Engineering at Harvard. And I just said, no, I'm not interested in leaving UBC at that point. And apparently I came home and I said to Nick, I just want to tell you, I got this phone call from Barb Gross at Harvard, and this is what I said. I just want to check with you in case you feel differently. And he said, no, I feel the same way. I want to stay at UBC. So, 6 months later, I got a phone call from, somebody on the search committee for the next dean of engineering at Princeton, who was a good friend of mine, and what he said was not, do you want to be a candidate for the dean of engineering position, but are you interested, would you be willing to do an hour-long conference call with the search committee, because we're asking about 30 people around the world to take a look at our current situation in the School of Engineering and Applied Science and give us their advice on who, what kinds of attributes we should be looking for in our next dean. Now, you know, if they called and said, would you be a candidate, I probably at that point would have said no. I mean, because I really did not want to leave UBC. And, but because they asked me to give them advice, I said sure. And so they sent me all these materials describing, you know, the departments and the current status of funding and this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, I read them all, and then I did my conference call with a search committee. And, of course, you know, there's no pressure. You're just providing advice. And, you know, after that phone call, I kept on waking up in the middle of the night thinking, you know, I should think, this should be something I think about doing, because this is exactly the kind of institution that has the visibility and the opportunity. I mean, people copy Princeton. So if Princeton does something, it will have an impact. And I ended up, after 3 weeks, calling back my friend who's on the search committee, he's a computer scientist called Bob Targin, who'd been a very long-term friend. And I called Bob and I said, Bob, you know, I realized that, you know, you guys are probably completely not interested in me, a candidate, for the position of Dean of Engineering, but I've been thinking about, you know, the conversation. I've been thinking a lot about the opportunity, and I've been wondering whether there might be any interest. And there's dead silence. And I go, Bob? And then still dead silence. And then I go, well, in any case, you know, we wouldn't consider coming unless the computer science department was interested in making Nick a full professor tenured offer. And he said, oh, the CS department has already talked about that. That's not a problem. And so I knew that they were really interested in me. And then Bob said, we just couldn't figure out any way that we could convince you to leave UBC in Vancouver. And so, you know, I ended up doing the interview. I ended up then going back a couple of months later for a second interview, met with the president. And, you know, I was pretty sure after that she was going to offer me the position. I was pretty sure I was going to take it. And when she called me a few days later to offer me the position, I accepted it without our negotiating the salary or anything else. And, you know, eventually, a few months later, we had to, you know, she's going, we have to decide on the salary somehow. And I said, fine. She said, well, how about I offer you the median salary for deans of engineering in the U.S.? I said, fine. But, you know, it was just, I felt like if I didn't say yes right away, I would never say yes. And I didn't leave UBC for another 6 months because our daughter was going into her final year of high school, and I was willing to commute for 6 months, but not for a year. And, I cried nonstop for 6 months about leaving UBC. I mean, it was just awful. And definitely one of the hardest decisions I've ever made.
So now you're at Princeton, and
now I'm at Princeton. So the deal I made with the president was that, you know, the engineering school felt very underfunded compared to the rest of Princeton University, and rightly so. And the problem was that I didn't know enough detail about what to ask for to make a sensible set of requests for what needed to be done for the engineering school. So the president and I agreed on the following, that if the engineering school would work with the rest of the university to create a strategic plan that everybody bought into, so not just the engineering school, but, you know, the trustees for the whole university and, you know, the senior leadership and so on, that we would then fundraise to fund the needs for that strategic vision. And I thought this was a good deal. I mean, it seemed to me, you know, that gives us time to really understand what needs to be done. It gives us, you know, Princeton is a very powerful fundraising machine. This is a good idea. And the first time I met with the faculty to tell them about this, they were not happy because the previous dean had basically made the same deal with the existing president at that point and had done a sort of a backroom, you know, had gotten together 20 senior people to write the strategic plan without consulting. There was about 125 faculty in the engineering school at Princeton. So without probably consulting people, had launched this plan, and said, you know, this is how we're going to bring in a lot of money. A few months later, maybe a year later, announces a $100 million gift, from, somebody called Sir Gordon Wu, who's a Princeton engineering alumnus. And then Sir Gordon's company went bankrupt after he had made only $38 million of the gift, and, you know, like the whole credibility of that strategic plan and the fundraising initiative went out the window with the faculty. So here was I arriving saying that I was going to do the same thing. Now, I should mention that Gordon rebuilt his company and eventually paid off the entire gift. Though this happened, he completed the gift in 2008 on his 50th anniversary. Reunion anniversary. So, I mean, this all happened after I had, you know, actually the completion of the gift happened after I had left. But, you know, the faculty were enormously skeptical about this proposal. And so somehow we had to find a way to do the strategic plan in a way that the faculty would actually believe in whatever got created. And so we created a completely different way of doing strategic planning. And we had a group of about 6 people working on it. And what we decided was, I mean, usually you have some kind of consultant and they do a whole bunch of things with people. And we decided that there was so much skepticism about consultants that we wouldn't use any consultants. And we decided that what we would do is we would essentially have all the moderators be faculty, alumni, and trustees and staff. And so that all of the work and leadership would be actually done by the community. And we ended up holding 11 one-day workshops over 3 months and on 11 different topics. And we picked the topics by, first of all, soliciting suggestions for topics from the faculty, the students, the staff, the alumni. And then we bucketed them and then into these 11 different buckets. And then we picked a steering committee for each workshop of about 15 people that was roughly half faculty from the engineering school and then staff, students, faculty from other parts of the university and alumni, faculty from other institutions to actually design the workshop. And then, you know, ran these workshops and did it. Absolutely everything that got said was published on the web and anyone could read it. So it was an extraordinarily open process. And then afterwards we summarized what had come out of things, and we made a PowerPoint presentation that was the draft of what was going to go in the strategic plan, and we gave it to about a dozen different groups. So we gave it to each department, we gave it to students, we gave it to alumni in different parts of the country, and every time we got feedback, we would edit the PowerPoint presentation on the fly so that, again, that everybody could see it evolving. And by the time we got to the end of the process, basically every person bought into 80% of the vision, and not the same 80%. And so it was approved by the trustees, it was launched, and the really interesting thing is that when I announced that I was going to Harvey Mudd College about a year and a half after we launched the vision, maybe 2 years after we launched the vision, to a person, all of the engineering department chairs went to the president and said, you have to hire an internal person as the dean because we've got our strategic vision and we're not changing it. And if you bring in an outside dean, they'll want to change it. And she sort of went, we can't do that. We always do an external search. But eventually, under pressure from everyone, they did an internal search. And, you know, what's really exciting is that, you know, it's been 6 years since I left Princeton and they are still, you know, they're still following the strategic vision. It's doing really well. The person who replaced me as dean, Vince Poor, has done a fantastic job. And, you know, I often say I've never been so successful in creating as much change during a short period of time as what happened at Princeton over 3.5 years.
So you really have described the opportunities and challenges at Princeton. Do you have any more to add?
I'd say that the thing I learned about being at Princeton is when you're at a very successful institution, it's actually much harder to make change happen because successful institutions are always worried about changing what makes them successful, and you seldom really know what makes you really successful. So it was a very good place for training in some ways before coming to Harvey Mudd College, because Mudd is also very successful. And I think one of the things you have to learn in each institution is what the culture is and where the levers are to create change. And at Princeton, the levers for creating change are, you know, Princeton really cares about a number of things. They care very deeply about undergraduate education. They care a lot about teaching. They care, they don't care a lot about other institutions other than maybe Harvard and Yale, MIT and Stanford. I mean, that's really the only places they see as competitors. And so you have to, if you want change to happen, you have to couch it in terms of what the institution values. And I had a wonderful mentor. He's basically the person in charge of administration, facilities, and so on for Princeton. This guy called Mark Burstein. And Mark is one of the best change agents I've ever seen. And he manages to get it done without getting people upset or, you know, and just having the opportunity to, Mark actually joined Princeton about 6 months after I did, and he claims that I was the person who persuaded him to come. I'm sure he tells everyone that, but we're still really good friends. And, you know, watching Mark showed me an approach to doing things that I had never really seen. I mean, it just is, he has an extraordinary extraordinary talent for change management. I also, I mean, one of the things that I did at Princeton was there had been some real unhappiness about from engineering students about how math was taught. And so I actually joined the team of people in the math department teaching Math 104, which is the first math course that most engineering majors take. And that was just a wonderful experience. I mean, I love teaching calculus. I loved getting to know, and I still, you know, like, for instance, one of the students from the first section I taught of that is doing her PhD at Caltech right now in geosciences. Another student is at Microsoft and is about to go back and do his PhD in computer science. I mean, there's something about the actual experience of really teaching that was just an amazing opportunity. I also, one of the things that when I arrived, there was sort of this feeling among the engineering students that everyone looked down on them. It's sort of like the engineering students, the courses were harder, they had to take more courses, and sort of the attitude from other students was, why would you do that? And so one of the things, together with the Engineering Undergraduate Society, it's called the E-Council, we started a series of dinners for first-year engineering students. So I, for the fall, would eat like two or three dinners a week in the residence halls with between 8 and 12 students and a couple of members of the E-Council, and just talk to them about where they were from and why they wanted to major in engineering and what they like best, what they like least, all those kinds of things. And, you know, by the time I left, engineering had become one of the most popular areas, and, you know, and people were saying, why don't we have a dean who comes, you know, from the other departments? Why don't we have someone who comes and has dinner with us? And, you know, it was just, I think the thing I loved best about Princeton was how much they cared about the students and the opportunity to have really great relationships with so many of the students.
So you've had this great time at Princeton, and then you get this offer from Harvey Mudd. So why Harvey Mudd?
Well, I mean, the first thing I should say is that if you're a female administrator at Princeton who's semi-competent, you will be asked to apply for a job as provost or president at least twice a week. I mean, and I don't think it's really so much that they're interested in you in particular. It's, there's a big tradition of people going from positions at Princeton to be presidents or provosts elsewhere, and people generally, search consultants are looking to have some women, particularly women in science and engineering, are on their candidate list. And so I had this automatic reply. I mean, it wasn't really, but, you know, I would get a phone call or an email or something, and I would just write back and I would say, I'm honored to have been nominated for this position. I have no intention of leaving Princeton in the next several years. I wish you the best for your search. And what happened was, when Mudd sent their email saying I'd be nominated for the position, they actually had, as many of them did, they had a prospectus attached to it. And the only reason I clicked on it was that I'm, as you know, extremely interested in mathematics education, and Mudd had an amazing reputation for innovation with mathematics education. So I clicked on the attachment, and I read it, and it just sounded, the person they described sounded exactly like me. So when Nick came home that day, I said, Nick, read this, because it sounds exactly like me. So he read it, and he says, yeah, it sounds exactly like you, but we're not moving. We just got here, and every time we move, I lose a year of my research life, and I don't have that many years left. And I went, yeah, you're right. We're not interested in moving. And then I said, but you know, my next job is going to be as president, and you know, we don't want to live in New Jersey forever. We want to move back to the West Coast. So let's think about what other universities we might find as appealing as Harvey Mudd College. And we came up with maybe five or six. And then I said, you know, these presidential searches, I mean, they always have many great candidates. You know, there's no guarantee that I would succeed in landing any position. And he goes, well, why don't you send them your resume and tell them that you're not a serious candidate? So I did exactly that. So the next thing that happened was the co-chair, one of the board members who's co-chairing the search, came out to visit me. And he had asked to take me out for a glass of wine in Princeton. And I said, no way, this town is way too small. You can come have a glass of wine and have dinner with us at our house. So he did. And this is somebody called Ed Johnson, a wonderful person, and just, you know, we had, you know, we talked for maybe 5 hours. I told him all the reasons they really shouldn't want me as president. And, you know, he told me all the reasons why I should want to be president at Harvard Med College. And, you know, he went away and we left it that I wasn't a serious candidate. And then the next thing they did was ask me to meet with the search committee, and I couldn't make the dates, and I just said no, I couldn't do it. And then about a month later, they asked me to meet on a different date with the search committee that I actually could do. I was going to be in Seattle, University of Washington for something, and it wouldn't be that hard to fly to Palm Springs on the way back. So I did. And of course, when you don't want a job, you interview at your very best. I mean, or maybe when you don't want a job, that makes them want you more. And so then the next thing was they said they wanted to talk to a couple of references, and I'm going, no, I'm not a serious candidate. You know, this has got to end now. And they go, oh, you know, it's just, we know you're not a serious candidate, but it's so helpful to be able to compare you to the other candidates. Okay, well, I let them talk to a couple of my associate deans. And then it was, you know, come and visit the campus. And that was the killer because, you know, Nick and I came to the campus and we met the students for the first time. And, you know, the MUD students are just amazing. And we really met a group of faculty for the first time. And the MUD faculty are just amazing. But, you know, we still were sure we were staying at Princeton. And then, you know, maybe another, you know, 10 days after that, they called and made the offer. And I'm, you know, just basically said, you know, if I have to decide while we're at Princeton, I'm staying at Princeton because, you know, it's really, you know, things are going really well. We're really happy here. And I said, but if you want to have a chance, you're going to need to wait until we're going to Pender Island on the 26th of December. And if you wait for a couple of days after we've been there, then at least I'll be deciding in a neutral place. And I think you know the story that, you know, we were staying at Princeton until the very last moment. And literally at the last moment, I was painting at the kitchen table, looked out, a shaft of sunlight hit the water after it being gray and gloomy for the previous, you know, 48 hours, and I just sort of had this thing about, oh my goodness, this is this incredible opportunity that I'm about to miss, and changed my mind right then and there, and now I've been here for 6 years, and it's an amazing place.
So now you're at Harvey Mudd. So can you go into more detail about your roles and contributions at Mudd?
So Harvey Mudd College needed had not done a strategic plan nor a campaign in a very long time. And so the first thing we needed to do was to do a strategic plan or strategic vision for the college. And so that's what I spent my first 6 months, so really more like 8 months eventually doing here. And we used the same process as we used at Princeton. It had worked so well there, and it also worked really well here. So that was the first thing. And, you know, we're well along the way in implementing that vision. We have, our faculty have completely revised the core curriculum in very exciting ways. And we have a new teaching and learning building under construction that's about halfway done right now that is going to completely transform our space. I ended up, you know, gradually replacing all of the vice presidents except for one. Not always because I wanted to. I mean, a couple of cases where people decided to leave, but, you know, I have ended up with what I call the dream team. And it's just the most amazing group of people to work with. I adore every single one of my vice presidents and also my Karen and Jimmy, who directs the president's office. I mean, and, you know, that took several years, but, you know, I feel like I've got both extremely strong individuals in leadership positions as well as a team that works better than, I've always had great teams, but this is my best team ever. So, we had a lot of work to do with our board in terms of, we didn't have term limits in place, so we put term limits in place. I'd say probably about 40% of our board is new since I arrived, so that's, you know, a lot of turnover, and, you know, we've recruited some really great people. I'm very proud of how our board functions now. It functions really well. We have our first alumni board chair, and I would say, you know, the biggest thing over the last couple of years has been just focusing on increasing our visibility, because if you want people to copy what you do, they have to know about how great you are. And so, and, you know, even just in the last year, the amount of visibility has increased just enormously. And, you know, a lot of this, the person who really started this for us was Sheryl Sandberg, in that she's very passionate about getting more women into technology leadership roles, and she was just blown away about what we did with her computer science program, and so she's been talking about us a lot, but so is everyone now. So, and, you know, I think we're now, I would say that when I arrived, we had fabulous faculty and students, and we had fabulous staff in a number of areas, but I would say the quality of our staff and our services has really dramatically improved. Our number of applications we receive each year has doubled since I arrived. Our number of women, they were about 30% of the student body, and now they're going to be over 45% of the student body. I think our incoming class this year is 48%. Our number of women faculty, probably 15 years ago, it was less than 10%, and now it's in the mid-40s in terms of our faculty. So it's just, it's a new institution, and I would say the other thing we've worked really hard on, and I'm super happy about, is the curriculum at Harvey Mudd College is really harder than any place on the face of the earth. And our grade point average is like 3.1. And these are all students who would be a 4.0 if they went to Berkeley or UCLA. So, and they literally work maybe 100 hours a week every week. And when I arrived, there was this thing called the bitterness factor that the students talked to me about, which was students who were graduating who were sort of saying, oh, I'm graduating with 3.1, I worked so hard, and what do I have to show for it? And I can now tell you that our student body is, the phrase parents and students use is deliriously happy. They're still working as hard. The grade point average hasn't changed at all, but they're really happy. And I'd say I do an informal survey with the students at graduation time. And I would say when I arrive, maybe half of the students, and the question I ask is, would you do it over again? Would you come to Mudd again? And maybe half of the students would say yes and half would say no. And today, at our graduation in May, I had exactly one student who said no. I had, maybe 70% of the students say in a heartbeat. And the remaining students said, yeah, I think so. I'm not sure I'd recommend somebody else. So, that happiness, the buzz on campus is just amazing. And, we are here for these students. We are trying to make this the most extraordinary 4 years of their life in terms of their growth as human beings, their growth in knowledge, their growth and ability to learn, their growth and ability to work with others, to communicate, all of these kinds of things. And I really feel it happens here. And there's something incredibly magical about being at a place that does exactly what it says it does. And that's very precious.
It's interesting. Do you still have this kind of idea of I guess maybe not all of the elements, but, at UBC you had this idea of, research, teaching, the team, the community, all about respect, trust, collaboration. Are you able to instill that?
It was here before I came. We live and breathe trust, respect, collaboration. Right now we have, of our 750 students, we have 206 students on campus doing research this summer. And to give you a sense of what it's like, so, my husband Nick is a mathematician, theoretical computer scientist. And, last summer he had these two students that were the best he'd ever worked with. And, he always has a set of problems ready for them to work on. And of course these aren't problems that anyone knows the answers to. And last summer they solved the first problem and wrote the paper giving the solution in the first 5 days. Okay, well, he said to me yesterday evening, he said, I want to invite our students over for dinner. And I said, great, when do you want to do it, et cetera. And then he said, this is going to be my best team yet. And I said, okay, how many research papers are going to come out of the summer? And he said, either 4 or 5. So 10 weeks of research with one student who's going to be a junior next year and one student who's going to be a senior next year. So, the kids are just incredible. And we have a new faculty member of biology, Elizabeth Glader, and she just joined us in January, and we're doing this launch of our summer program for African-American boys, a math camp that we do with Claremont Graduate University and the Long Beach School District. And Elizabeth is one of our African-American faculty members, so she was there for the launch. And I said, so how's your research going? She said, oh, it's just incredible. I've got these two amazing students. And she said, and they were renovating something in my lab this week, so we were told not to come into the lab on a certain day because it was going to be too dusty for us to work. And she said to the students, well, you know, you guys can take the day off. And the students go, no, can't we work in somebody else's lab that day? I mean, it's just an amazing place. So, you know, I often talk about MUD being like, you know, the very best of Canada.
MUD is also part of, what, the Claremont chain? And have you any sort of new roles within that sort of chain of colleges?
So the Claremont colleges are a consortium, and they're actually all side by side. So it makes up a jigsaw puzzle. So the seven presidents together with the CEO of the consortium meet roughly once a month. And because we share libraries, health services, a number of academic programs, various other sort of support kinds of things. And one of the amazing things right now is that of the seven presidents, five are female. It's the highest concentration of female presidents, academic presidents in the nation. They're a great group of people to work with. And, you know, it's a tremendous benefit both to our faculty and students to be part of this larger academic collaboration, because our students take courses at all the other colleges. And, you know, for instance, our students are very musical, but we only have one real music faculty member at MUD. But our students make up between 40% and 50% of all the musical ensembles across the Claremont Consortium. And they, you know, there's just no way they could have, so there's a, you know, a jazz band, a symphony orchestra, several choruses, two orchestras, a string ensemble, all of these kinds of things. And they simply would not get that kind of access to those kinds of musical opportunities without having the consortium.
So Maria, where are your research interests and their lasting impact? Well, at University of Toronto, UBC, Princeton, and MUD.
So the University of Toronto, my primary research interest was theoretical computer science. And, you know, I'd say that and discrete mathematics were, you know, continued to be my main research interests until about 1992, which is while I was at UBC. And in 1992, I was asked to be one of the keynote lecturers at the International Congress of Mathematics Educators. And I had been doing, as I mentioned, mathematics education has been a passion of mine my entire life. And I had been doing something called Scientists in the Schools, where I went out to visit classrooms, and I did everything from kindergarten through 12th grade across BC. And essentially what I usually talked about was the mathematics that underlies computer animation. And, you know, we do a number of different activities with students of different ages. And I was asked to give this talk at the conference was in Ottawa in summer of 1992. And just by chance, I was going to give one of the 45-minute addresses, and there were probably, I don't know, 40 people doing this. And there were 4 1-hour plenary addresses, and the Canadian who was there's always somebody from the home country gives one of the 1-hour addresses, and he had a stroke, and I got asked to fill in for him. And one of the consequences was that I had to write a paper because of giving my talk in advance, so that the people who were doing the simultaneous translation into different languages would have it to look at ahead of time. And while I wrote the paper, I essentially wrote this paper called Bringing Mathematical Research to Life in the Schools. And one of the things I realized as I was writing it was that I became convinced that what I was doing by doing these, you know, 1-hour visits in a classroom was I wasn't having much impact, and that one should start, you would have a lot more impact if you could actually create a computer-based or video game activity that really embedded mathematics in game-like activities where you could motivate students to discover mathematical things themselves. And so I ended up starting this project called Electronic Games for Education in Math and Science, EGEM. And so while I was at UBC, I continued, I led the EGEMS project, for 10 years while I was at UBC. And, you know, I had maybe about 50 students, undergraduate students, work with me on that, and, a number of graduate students as well, during that 10-year period. And it was a collaboration, with the Vancouver School District and with several schools in particular. And then eventually, when I had this NSERT chair funded by IBM Canada for, women in science and engineering, we expanded it to doing activities around computer science as well, and, you know, really working on trying to get more females into areas like computer science, mathematics, and physics, and so on. So one of the things that came out of the EGEMS project, which I hadn't really anticipated, was that I ended up getting very interested in gender issues in computer and video games. And the reason was that when I started this, when I gave my talk in Ottawa, I had a lot of people come up to me and say, you know, boys are much more into playing video and computer games than girls are, and, you know, surely you don't want to create yet one more way where you can advantage boys over girls in learning math. And so the first research that we did, which was in the summer of 93, was a study at Science World in BC, where we basically had an exhibit that had video games, computer games, and a game design area. And we had researchers there 8 hours a day, 7 days a week for 2 months, and we observed what boys and girls did. And we learned a tremendous amount about the difference between what boys liked in computer and video games, what girls liked, and also in the differences in the ways that they played. So one part of EJAMS was, I think we were really the first group to do research on gender differences, and one of the first groups to do really research on educational computer games. And as I was leaving UBC to go to Princeton, Anita Borg, who's a very close friend of mine, was dying from brain cancer. And one of the things I wanted to do for Anita, I wanted to give her something in the last 6 to 8 months of her life where she felt that she was contributing something positive to society, because she had, you know, as the founder of the Institute for Women in Technology and, you know, just an incredibly passionate leader around access and equity in technology, it was very hard for her to be in a situation where she felt that she couldn't contribute. And so we decided to do some research on the use of information technology to assist people with aphasia, which is the loss of cognitive deficits in language, which was something that Anita was suffering from. And we decided that we would put together this team, mostly at UBC, but then when I went to Princeton, I gathered, ended up with 3 PhD students working on it as well, and so it became a UBC-Princeton joint initiative. And we were able to do some design work with Anita, and, you know, both Anita's sister and mother told me that being part of that project was incredibly important for her, because it was, you know, a way that she could still make a contribution, even, you know, as, I mean, one of the things about dying from a brain tumor is, at least for Anita, it was as though she was regressing in life, and it came a time when, you know, she couldn't feed herself, and so her mother and sister were feeding her and so on. This was something she could be part of and know about and feel like, you know, she was still making a difference. And so I ended up working in the area of assistive technology for about 4 years. And I would say now that I'm at MUD, I've ended up going back to doing more discrete mathematics, but also spending more time on educational games. And there's been a resurfacing of interest in using game-based approaches for mathematics learning. And so I'm not actively working with anyone, but I'm paying attention to it and am, you know, sort of not an official consultant, but in some sense an advisor for some of the groups that are doing this, and I'm really enjoying that too.
Maria, the work that you've done is just so inspiring, and I can see the audience wanting to get into the various aspects that, or perhaps even modeling many of the things that you've done. Now, we're going to take a bit of a shift. Can you describe your good and bad experiences during your later academic career and how they influenced you?
Yeah. So, you know, one thing, I think one thing that is always true of me, and, you know, and it's something that I try to compensate for regularly, but I think it will always be a tendency I have. I'm a wonderful person to the people who report to me and who I'm leading. I mean, I'm extremely good to those people in terms of trusting them and giving them a lot of responsibility and sharing a lot of information with them. And I'm also somebody who, you know, the joke in my family is, if you want Maria to do something, tell her it's impossible. And so I push very hard on the people that I report to. And you know, it's part of, you know, I think it's partly because I'm very goal-directed. So, for example, when I went into the position as the Vice President for Student Academic Services, I was very clear in my interview that I was reasons I was doing this, and I was pretty horrified when 3 weeks later into the job, the president told me that the things I wanted to work on, the student experience and an information technology infrastructure plan for the campus, were not priorities and were not something he was going to support. And I just sort of went, so why did you pick me? You know, like, how crazy is that? And he just said, well, you know, I was pretty sure once you actually became vice president, you'd realize there were much more strategic other priorities. And so, you know, I did achieve what I set out to achieve, but it was really hard because, you know, and I eventually had to do it by making it a priority for the campus, not my priority, so that because it was something the president was not supporting, but when enough of the faculty and students got behind it, eventually it had to happen. But it, you know, one of the mistakes I make over and over again in my life is that I assume that because I'm very honest about what I intend to do, that people are recruiting me, intending me to do those things. And, one of the experiences is that I've had is, you know, for instance, going to Princeton, they explicitly said they were hiring me as a change agent. I mean, that was the term that Shirley Tilghman used. And, you know, Shirley Tilghman is one of the university presidents I have enormous respect for and affection for. She's really, and I'm sure you know she's Canadian. But I don't think they expected to be asked to change as many things as I wanted to change. And when I was hired at MUD, again, I was explicitly hired as a change agent, and they said they wanted all these things. They wanted a dynamic leader. They wanted, you know, this, that, and the other thing. And as some of the faculty said, you know, at the beginning of my second year, they said, we thought that's what we wanted, but we had no idea what a shock to the system it would be. And, you know, so I think one of the experiences that I'm learning is that no matter how good a job you try to do of being clear about what you're trying to achieve, people don't really believe it. And that when you come and do things, you actually have to make a lot of changes when you move to a new institution, or even to a new role at the same institution, in how you accomplish things, because the culture of different organizations is just different, and it's not effective trying to impose your culture on them. You have to figure out how to function within that culture, and so you know, I think some of the hardest parts of being, you know, just the degree of disillusionment that happens when, you know, you really think there was an agreement to do something and you find out that maybe things were said, maybe things were even written, but in reality you have to keep negotiating over and over again, and, you know, like, it's just life. So I think hardest thing situations I faced at UBC was that in the late 1990s, 2001, just before the crash of the dot-com bubble, computer science, and this is happening again right now, computer science faculty salaries were going up spectacularly. And while I was dean of science, there was one day when finally the number of people from our computer science department that I had built, the number of people who told me that they were searching for jobs elsewhere because, you know, they just couldn't, it just given that they could earn twice as much at a more prestigious institution, it just made no sense. And so more than half of the people had told me that they were on the job market. And I had been trying for several months to convince the provost that we had to do something about this, that we just couldn't, we were going to lose one of the best departments in the university if we didn't respond to this in some way. And the provost, you know, kept on promising to do something but just didn't do anything. And the provost was in a very tough place because there was a lot of resistance from the faculty association and from other parts of the university to allowing salaries for a department to be on a different scale from other departments. And they had done it for the business school, they had done it for the medical school, but they were very reluctant. They really needed to do it for electrical engineering and computer science. And I had felt that because I was a computer science faculty member and because my husband Nick was also in the department, that if I actually proposed the solution, it was a conflict of interest. And, you know, I just couldn't make any progress. And I remember I happened to be on a visit to Princeton to do some research with colleagues in the CS department at Princeton, and talking to a couple of my best friends. One was Bob Targin, who I already mentioned is the person who primarily recruited me to Princeton. The other one was Avi Vigerson, another extremely close friend. And talking to them about this, and I remember Avi said, he said, Maria, there are procedures for dealing with conflict of interest. The fact that you have a conflict of interest doesn't mean if the provost is not going to deal with it, you have to deal with it. And you just have to declare that you have a conflict of interest and put the plan in place. And I went back and I did that, and it was brilliant. And in fact, you know, we only lost one person, whereas, you know, I had, you know, probably between 15 and 20 people tell me that they were planning to leave. And, you know, it was also just a very good lesson, because I had allowed the fact that I was in a position of conflict to cause me not to act instead of taking responsibility for something that really had to be solved. And that was definitely one of my hardest times. I mean, it's very hard to have built a department and then see it falling apart.
So Maria, from your mid to current career path, how would you describe yourself? That is, your attitude, your aspirations, your approach to societal contributions, family, friends, activities, interests, hobbies, life in general.
So, I mean, obviously the first thing is, you know, I wake up every morning just so happy that I have my husband and my kids in my life. I mean, it's just I feel unbelievably lucky to have been able to combine that with having a career that, you know, I think is a very ambitious career and that, you know, I put my heart and soul into. And, you know, I think about this a lot, because I don't know if you saw, there was an article by Anne-Marie Slaughter, who's a former dean at Princeton, who was dean at the same time as I was, talking, it was in the Atlantic Monthly, and the title was Why Women Can't Have It All. And I don't believe anyone can have it all. But I do feel like one of the things that has been incredibly fortunate about is that because I have had Nick in my life, who's incredibly supportive, and two totally amazing children who are now, you know, 27 and 30, so they're not really children anymore. That's been, you know, they are more important to me than my actual career, but I'm, as you know, really passionate about what I'm trying to do with my life, with my career. And so just the combination of those things is I give thanks for it every single day. I have also tried really hard to have other things in my life, painting in particular, exercise. For a long time I ran marathons. I seem to have hurt my knee hiking last summer, so I'm no longer running, but getting all kinds of exercise is really important to me. Reading, having close friends all around the world and managing to actually spend time with them is also really, really good. One of the things I've become more, I think, more intentional about over the last 20, 25 years is thinking about the combination of my day job, which of course right now is being president of Harvey Mudd College, and my life goals, and thinking about how those two interact. And, you know, my life goals are, I want to change the culture of science engineering so that it's more supportive of people who are not the norm, whether it's because of gender or race or because you're gay or whatever. I want to significantly improve mathematics education, particularly in the United States, where it's much worse than, say, it is in British Columbia or Alberta. And I want to focus what we do as scientists and engineers on the major problems that face the world. And, you know, to make that, you know, to really think about, you know, what we're doing about diseases in developing countries, and what we're doing about education in developing countries, and what we're doing about women in developing countries, and all those kinds of things. And that's a, you know, those are things that are much bigger than any particular job I have. But one of the things I feel incredibly lucky about right now is I get both to be part of this extraordinary institution that's Harvey Mudd College, and I get to spend time and energy on the other things I really care about. And that's pretty amazing. And I happened to see Mark Burstein at Princeton when I was back for a workshop a couple of weekends ago, and he was saying, Maria, you look really great. And I said, yeah, Mark, I think this is probably about the happiest time in my life ever, because it feels like I'm getting to combine so many different things that I love, and I feel like I'm making a difference. And that's really good.
We've captured so much from the deep insights that Maria has that we'll need to continue this final interview. So I'm going to conclude this part by saying that I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this finishes our exclusive interview, at least the first portion of it, with Dr. Maria Clavey, pioneering world-renowned computer scientist, president of Harvey Mudd College, board director of Microsoft and Broadcom, keynote speaker at the first World CIO Forum, past Dean of Engineering, Professor of Computer Science at Princeton University, former Vice President and Dean of Science at the University of British Columbia in Canada. This is the first part of our final interview in an interview series where we explored Maria's considerable history from her early years and into her professional life of notable distinction, significant outstanding contributions in a number of fields including societal causes.